people actually pay for goods this way. You know, you go to an agent, you give him money, he does the exchange rate, he sends money to someone in Uganda, if you're in Tanzania, you come back to the same bus station a few days later and, you know, you pick your goods, right? So it's digital. Like, there's the digital transaction enablement that's happening. The fact that it's not, you know, a fancy app or, you know, a flashy user interface doesn't make it less digital. And so, you know, the idea is work with these people, work with this information, work with this state of affairs, and build.
For the nearly 10 years that we've been tracking venture capital flows into Africa, fintech has attracted the lion's share. Last year, for example, Rider Bridges, The Big Deal, and Partech all reported that fintech accounted for 40% of equity funding. But why is that? One potential starting point is the third principle from the Trajectory Africa's previous series. Fintech is an important enabler for digitizing African economies because it provides foundational infrastructure. But fintech isn't synonymous with financial system. So what should Africa's financial systems look like? What are their key components and what jobs should they do? What role does technology play and how does this tech function in cash-driven informal economies? These are just some of the questions that Samora Kariuki, founder of the Frontier Fintech Newsletter and director of SOTE, a company that's building African supply chain infrastructure, is tackling on this episode of The Trajectory Africa. Let's dive in.
You know, it's kind of funny because it took me a while to commit to working on this series. But once I did, I knew I wanted to read everything I could get my hands on. And although I'm a bit ashamed to admit that I was quite late to the party, I feel very fortunate to have stumbled across your newsletter, Frontier Fintech. It's a really, really great resource. And I actually used it a bit like a primer to nail down the basics of fintech. And so I read almost all of your articles. So when I decided to anchor the series with an exploration of what a functional digitally enabled financial system would look like, I knew I really wanted to chat with you. So thanks again for joining me, Samora. I'm really excited to dive in.
Thanks, Daya. I mean, I get people telling me a number of things. They still read all the newsletters. Some say that they use my newsletter for interview preps, and I still get subscribers up to today. So it's a huge pleasure, a huge honor. Thank you.
No, it's very, very robust. It's definitely, the work that you did is definitely a public service. So why don't we start there with the newsletter? What motivated you to launch it, and what were you hoping to accomplish?
So thanks. There are a number of things I was trying to accomplish. One of them was just sharpening my insights into fintech. So, you know, I've had a career in finance, mostly on the stock record side, and then into banking. And you know, within the belly of the beast, as you'd call it, in banking, it you know, becomes clear how much more technology can play into improving banking in general and finance in general. And so fintech has, you know, became a passion project for me professionally. And I thought that let me sharpen my insights by writing about various topics. And what better than to write in public and just share your insights and you know, just get all the feedback you can get. So that was one. And I think around the time, this guy Naval Ravikant had written about how you need to do things that have leverage. And so that is, you know, things like coding, writing in public, producing software, things that have, you know, multiple layers of leverage. And those two ideas came together, you know, the idea of learning in public and sharpening insights, as well as doing something that has leverage. And I think, you know, that is what actually led me to now start the newsletter. I think once I got going and, you know, the first couple of articles and the feedback from that, I just got motivated to do more and more. So that's what motivated me to start.
Yes, there's nothing like thinking, writing, and sharing in public to sharpen your own level of insights. And I can imagine it has quite a bit of leverage, very strategic. And in fact, that's one of the motivations, the desire to learn that motivated the launch of this podcast, actually. Has the work had an impact on you and the work that you're currently doing?
Yeah, I mean, the newsletter definitely opened a number of doors. In fact, a lot of opportunities came out through the newsletter, and a lot of networks that even led to what I'm currently doing. And the interesting thing is that it's not just the networks. I think what helped, and this was kindly part of the motivation behind it, is having a nose or developing a sense for what opportunities are useful and what opportunities will not work. Because I know fintech and I know, well, this won't work. Well, this can work. Well, I can help you with this. Well, even if it was to help you, I really wouldn't help you there. So that led to now where I currently am, where it's a logistics company with a fintech play. And it's driven mostly through two things, embedded finance and data, and how banks can leverage non-conventional sources of data to improve lending. And in this case, it was trade finance data that is embedded in logistics.
This idea of developing a sense of what's useful based on experience is exactly why I wanted to have you on the show. So let's talk fintech. I'm sure you're aware, I mean, without a doubt, you're aware that there's been a lot of discussion about fintech attracting the majority of investment capital flowing into Africa, although the distribution seems to be evening out. And my operating assumption, based on a conversation I had with Barbara Iyayi of Unicorn Growth Capital in the previous series, is that the case for fintech as a conduit for fundamental value is a role that it plays in foundational infrastructure for the digital economy. The idea being that people, of course, have to move money, they need to pay, save, borrow, invest, et cetera. But I'm curious about your perspective, given your experience. Why is fintech so important? And what problems are digitally delivered financial services actually supposed to solve for people?
Well, there's a whole host of problems to be solved. And I think just adding to, I think, Barbara's point, one of the things I always say is that if you consider GDP, like gross domestic product, right? And gross domestic product is the sum total of the market value of all goods and services sold within an economy, right? And so behind all that, there's a payment. Like behind every exchange of goods and services is a payment. And therefore, just using that framework, improving the way people make payments has a direct impact into GDP and therefore livelihoods. And fintech is one very important way of, you know, really improving payments infrastructure. Even within this whole discussion of GDP, there is lending. Like you could make a payment, but underlying that payment was a loan or a borrowing. And fintech has a role to play in making that better. And I think one of the other things, you know, within fintech, maybe is a controversial thing, but you know, it becomes clear that fintech, if done well, can be capital efficient in terms of enabling scale without much more investment. You know, if you consider traditional industries such as, you know, extraction or agriculture or construction, that fintech is one of the ways where you can really make capital. It's a capital efficient frontier for business. So I think that's what drives a lot of interest in fintech. The big picture is that if you get fintech right, you can really have an unachievable impact on the economy, and it's capital efficient. And if you look at M-Pesa, there are studies that have shown that M-Pesa actually contributes to higher incomes for people, and there's an unachievable impact on GDP. And I think even if you look across in India and the success they've achieved with UPI, it just shows the power of fintech. So I think, yeah, fintech is a very important space for the continent, and the investments and the continued interest is justifiable.
Indeed. So in terms of the capital efficiency aspect, so the argument is that digitally enabled financial services contribute to GDP, and that there's a capital efficiency to building these types of businesses. On the capital efficiency point, it's kind of funny. So in a conversation I had with Abraham Augustine of Tech Cabal last week, we were talking about how much physical infrastructure goes into fintech given the cash in, cash out model. So how capital efficient can fintech be depending on what model you're running? So how far does that capital efficiency go?
So even using the cash in, cash out model for agency, you know, agency banking or agency whatever, right, like mobile money, I look at it as what's the alternative for achieving the same impact, right? Now, traditionally, you'd have to build brick and mortar branches. The reason why banks in Africa, and I think this is one reason that is not talked about enough, the reason why banks in Africa did not really build out their branching infrastructure, and I think there are statistics around the number of branches or the number of ATMs per 100,000 people. And, you know, we look at countries like Nigeria and South Africa, and Kenya, they rank at the bottom of such stats. The reason why banks didn't do the infrastructure is because if you look at as a continent, you look at the size of each country, you know, I think the maps that show how big Africa really is, and if you look at the population density, it really doesn't make sense from a, you would call it GDP per capita per square meter or per square kilometer. It doesn't make sense to set up physical infrastructure. And so fintech, if you look at agency banking or mobile money as a subset of fintech, then it's not so much, you know, is setting up agents capital efficient. Is setting up agents more capital efficient than setting up a branch infrastructure? And does it achieve the same impact? And I think it does, not even a higher impact. So that's how I'd look at capital efficiency. And of course, there are a whole host of other things, like how companies like Flutter and Paystack can enable a whole host of transactions using technology that would previously require manual operations that would be way more capital inefficient. So I think that's the lens you need to use when you're looking at capital efficiency and fintech in Africa in terms of what would it cost to build the alternative.
Right. So it's capital efficiency relative to a more expensive, less efficient alternative. So you mentioned that part of what drew you into fintech was you saw how technology could improve banking and fintech. So what challenges are banks facing that create opportunities for fintech?
I think there's a whole host of challenges that you need to speak about. One that I've gotten more and more passionate over time is how credit is allocated across the economy. So, of course, you know, we're in 2023 now. I think a lot of economies in Africa have done a good job in financial inclusion on the basis of enabling people to have store value accounts, right? So if you look at mobile money or apps in Nigeria that enable people to, you know, like Kuda, that enable people to just open an account, I think that has gone on and continues to go on. But there's a limit as to how much financial inclusion you can actually have and what, you know, there's decreasing returns to additional financial inclusion. And therefore, the thing that now we should be talking about is, okay, now we have financial inclusion, can we move towards financial empowerment? And financial empowerment in this case is enabling people to get loans, right? And technology plays a role in terms of, you know, things like embedded finance, open finance, pulling information from additional data sources, you know, pulling information from tax returns, if that's even useful. Some countries, you know, don't have tax returns, you know, pulling third-party information, combining it, and giving people and businesses things like credit scores that enable them to access loans, right? Because when you dig deep into, you know, how lending works in this market, how lending works is basically through, you'd call them like almost patronage networks. Like, I know you, I have a good feeling about you, and therefore I continue lending to you, regardless of the fundamentals. So business A, the people have good relationships in the bank. Business B, they don't have as good relationships in the bank, but all the data points that business B is way better than business A. But business A will still continue getting loans. So I think credit enablement is something that's becoming more and more important to me, like in terms of how I see banks leveraging on technology to improve their services.
So I want to pick up your point about the link between financial empowerment and credit enablement. But I'm curious, because you made the point that investments in cash in, cash out versus full brick and mortar locations is more capitally efficient. But if you expand that a little bit, there's another question, which is essentially, why is infrastructure building even important, both for B2C and B businesses? I know the answer seems obvious, but I think it's worth drawing out.
You know, there's a whole layer of infrastructure that needs to be built, right? And the way to think about it, I think, is, you know, using the analogy of like Amazon in the States. When Amazon were building out their digital bookstore, they had underlying infrastructure that enabled them to do well. So first of all, they had good roads. They had a well-structured address system. They had the postal service, the American Postal Service, that could deliver parcels at low cost across the country. They had an airport network that could help coordinate cargo across multiple states. You know, America is a huge country. So there was an underlying infrastructure that enabled Amazon to succeed. Of course, you have, you know, a friendly banking system, a good capitalist system, and of course the legal system to help enforce law. So underlying every business, there's infrastructure, right? Now, in finance and banking, there's also infrastructure that's required for things to work well, right? So you need payments infrastructure. You need things like identity and KYC. You need the ability to move cash into and out of the system. You need the ability to hold value. And of course, you need data and credit scoring, right? A number of things that need to be done for the financial system to work, whether it's a digital financial system or an analog. But speaking about a digital financial system, you need all those things working. So some infrastructure is provided by the government, some can be built by the private sector, but all those things kind of need to work. They need to exist for a digital financial system to actually work.
So it sounds like you've kind of outlined the key elements of a functional financial system, which is excellent. But going back to your point about financial empowerment and credit enablement, maybe two things. One is, why do you feel so strongly about how extending credit can lead to financial empowerment? And what other jobs to be done should this system deliver to its users?
Yeah, and I think when you look at it from a Pan-African perspective, you know, first, then it needs to be easy to move money around the continent, right? That's very important, because I think statistics show that within any country, most of the immigration is between African countries. We always talk about African immigrants as people who are moving to the States or to Europe, but mostly they're moving within the continent. So even remittances and trade, you need to enable money to move between African continents much easier than it currently is the case. Of course, we spoke about financial inclusion. In some markets, you need to do, there's still a huge job to be done there in terms of financial inclusion. There is the credit aspect in terms of enabling credit. And of course, if you do money movement and inclusion, then you need to drive trade and commerce, right? And just make it easier. And these are things like instant settlements and settlement finality. And of course, now there are higher value services such as creating transactional identities so that you can personalize and improve financial services. But I think if I was to really summarize what are the four most important things, it's just the intercontinental money movement, financial inclusion, the credit piece, and the trade and commerce piece through better payments.
Those pillars sound like the core, and it definitely makes sense. You mentioned that some of these might be built by the private sector and some by other actors. Yes. Do you have a sense for which part of the system is best suited to be built by companies, essentially?
Okay, so going back, the four things like intercontinental money movement, financial inclusion, credit, trade and commerce, those are more like goals, right? Like these are the goals. This is what we want to achieve, right? Now, to achieve that, you need to build the following things. The following things are an identity framework, a payment system, cash in, cash out infrastructure, store value systems, credit scoring infrastructure, open data. Now, it's not like, you know, all these things fall within a continuum, if you could call it. It's not really binary that this has to be done by the private sector, this has to be done by the government. But there are some things where, you know, the government's role is critical. One of them being identity, right? And the ability to KYC, the ability to search for someone, confirm identity, confirm, you know, ID details. This is like a fundamental thing. And there are various ways that you can do ID. Of course, the Indian system called Aadhaar is really amazing and be useful if African countries can adopt such a thing. But, you know, using things like biometrics and transferable ID data so that you can enable someone to open a bank account, open insurance, buy insurance products and all that, that's really critical. So that is better done by the government than it does by the private sector, because identity, if you think about it, is, as citizens, you'd want it to be owned by the government as opposed to some private corporation that you can't hold to account per se. Of course, payments now is something that the private sector has done well and continues to do well, and that there are different ways you can do it. There's the mobile money framework for countries like Kenya and Ghana and Uganda and Tanzania. There's the card-based system that we see is largely, you know, if you look at markets like Europe, South Africa, to a large degree, even America. So payments is something that can be done by the private sector, and I think they'll do a better job there. So there's some things that fall within a continuum, and by continuum I mean like things like credit scoring infrastructure, right? So you can have private corporations that do the credit scoring, but there's an element of enforcement and regulation that the government can do a good job in. And by that, I mean embedding credit scores more and more into the fabric of society. I think in the West, the way credit scores work is that if your credit score is bad, it kind of affects everything in your life. And therefore, you've got a very strong incentive to maintain a rich credit score. And if you maintain a rich credit score, then the banks look at it that this matters. Like if someone has a credit score of 800, it matters, and therefore it can do such kind of lending. So if even if you have credit scores in Africa, if there's no kind of widespread enforcement of those credit scores and regulation that enables them to be consistent, then, you know, starts falling apart. So it's not a binary issue when you look at all those elements that need to be built.
No, definitely. It certainly can't be binary. And you're very correct that you have to talk about building infrastructure and not necessarily building goals. So apologies for misspeaking there. I have another obvious question for you on this. We are assuming that the system should be enabled by technology, and you've kind of alluded to why technology is critical, but if you could draw that out a little bit. So why does this financial system need to be driven by technology?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. And I think you need to go back to kind of fundamentals. You know, when you break down, when you talk about technology, technology is always of the day, right? So, you know, the example I use is, I think Rockefeller had an advantage when he was trading oil all those years back, because he had figured out a way of sending telegrams across his offices much faster than his competition. And therefore, he had an information advantage. And so, to an extent, you can call him a technology entrepreneur, right? Using that same framework, the question is, if you were to build a financial system now, why wouldn't you leverage the most advanced technologies? Like, you can actually leapfrog, and that's the word used. But technology enables you to leapfrog, look at things in terms of first principles better. So an example is like, you know, Kenya is rolling out a new ID system. And if they're rolling out the new ID system, then you have to say, okay, what can you actually accomplish with technology, with ID, with an ID system? You need to enable this ID system to be searchable. You need to enable it to you know, a database that can be queried across multiple service providers. You know, you go from a first principles approach and say, these are the things we need to do with our ID system. And if you do that, you'll eventually land to the conclusion that we need to use, you know, the latest technology, right? So, you know, it's just an issue of, for our time now, what makes the most sense. If you're to build a payment system, would you build one where people need to present a physical paper in a physical location? No, you can do something better than that. So it's not so much that it's a must, it's just that why wouldn't you use technology to build this financial system?
What I really appreciate about what you're saying is that you're not talking about technology for technology's sake. You're saying, what is the best way to build the system?
Yep.
We've come into an era where technology has advanced, and so there are better ways of getting jobs done. So if you want to build a good system, then you should use the best tools, which I think is a sort of very practical, common sense way to think about it.
Yeah.
But I suppose there's another consideration. If we go back to your earlier points about infrastructure building, the embedded assumption or unstated assumption there is that we're talking about infrastructure building, both physical and digital, in economies that are largely, quote unquote, informal and caste driven. Yeah. So the question becomes, how far can you go in terms of digitizing transactions in economies that are sophisticated, but also cash-driven and informal?
I think there's a long way to go. And I think I've got a lot to say about the whole moniker of formal and informal. You know, most of our economies are informal. So should we even call them informal, or should we just call them, that's just how they are? But, you know, using the informal like idea, when you go to the ground, you actually see that technology works, right? And I think there's a newsletter I wrote about how people actually trade within East Africa, right? So you've got these bus stops or bus stations or markets, but all markets have some kind of bus station where long-distance buses pick and ferry passengers. And within these markets, there's always mobile money, but these mobile money agents do multiple mobile money solutions. So you have someone in Tanzania who can do MTN Uganda, can do, you know, M-Pesa, can do Tigo in Tanzania, you know, has got all these kind of devices to enable all these transactions. And what happens is that people actually pay for goods this way, right? So you pay for goods, you know, you go to an agent, you give him money, he does the exchange rate, he sends money to someone in Uganda, where if you're in Tanzania, you come back to the same bus station a few days later and, you know, you pick your goods, right? So it's digital. Like there's the digital transaction enablement that's happening. The fact that it's not, you know, a fancy app or, you know, a flashy user interface doesn't make it less digital. And so, you know, the idea is work with these people, work with this information, work with this state of affairs and build. And I think that's what, you know, some traditional companies have done well, right? Like traditional companies such as Safaricom, you know, and I guess traditional, I mean, not a startup, not a VC's funded startup, is that they really work with just, this is the reality on the ground and this is the technology we build based on this ground reality. And so the challenge with cash and cash usage is that cash is actually a very useful technology, right? Cash never fails. Like, you know, there's no failed cash transaction. And there's always 100% settlement finality with cash. Like, I give you money, there's no questions about I gave you money or the transaction, you know, you haven't yet received the money or the transaction is stuck there. So the thing about cash is that it's actually more around trust. Like, I trust that this will work. And therefore, to really make a dent in cash-based societies is to build technology that has the same kind of robustness as cash. That's the first thing. The second thing you have to do, and this is where governments come in, is that a cash transaction has got no transaction fees. So if you break down transaction fees, and if you just look at, you know, maybe I'd use 1,000 naira or 1,000 shillings, and you look at how it circulates within the mobile money ecosystem, just 1,000 shilling, and how it circulates within the cash system, you know, within a month, like that 1,000 naira becomes like 50 naira or 100 naira. Well, within the cash system, it's still the same 1,000 because transaction fees eat this up. So, of course, the providers of the service have to charge what they need to charge. But this is where now taxes come in. And I think one thing that's really starting to have a negative impact on the adoption of mobile money and just digital transactions, specifically in East Africa, but we're seeing it across the continent, is now governments are getting more and more aggressive when it comes to taxing these digital transactions. So to your earlier point that the informality of the market has got nothing to do with whether it will adopt the technology. You just have to build a technology that works with that reality.
Really, really useful points here. I mean, you're absolutely right in in that calling, labeling an economy informal is pointless. It just kind of points to the fact that you're outside the economy that you're talking about, which I am. In fact, the Center for Global Development wrote a brief, and one of the lines that stands out to me from that brief is that they basically write that the informal economy is the economy in Africa, so you can just drop the informal part.
Yeah.
That last bit is my emphasis, not their words. So the idea of building to context makes complete sense. And the idea that cash never fails kind of highlights what you're competing against. So you actually have to build a system that works as well or better than cash for that reason. But what's interesting about the example that you point out is that, at least in that particular example, technology has a bit of a human face. So in a report I co-authored on VC in Africa called Chasing Outliers, that's something that we heard, that the technology was tech touch, if you like, that in a lot of cases there was, not all cases, but in many cases there was some level of human intermediation, which is interesting. So you mentioned that in Kenya there is a push to update, might not be the right word, but update the identification system, which suggests, and I might be reaching, that the way these systems develop could differ by geography. So do you have thoughts on whether the fundamental elements, the stack of the system, might differ by geography in meaningful ways?
Definitely. And what you're going to have is that you're going to have some African countries just, you know, kind of falling behind. And it's an unfortunate fact, right? So in countries like the DRC, you know, you'll struggle to find a centralized population registry, a centralized identification system. You know, sometimes it's done per, you know, based on the province, on the, you know, the whatever geographic or administrative frameworks they use in that country. So, you know, such countries, you know, could be left behind when you look at, you know, the progress countries like South Africa, Nigeria, Ghana, Kenya, Tanzania are making in terms of their identification systems. Because if you think about like what's happening with the UPI in India and, you know, similar digital payment systems in Singapore and, you know, Southeast Asia, then, or even China, then one natural conclusion is that these payment systems will integrate. And therefore, some of these identity systems will have to be acceptable, right? So, you know, if you can imagine, let's say India and Singapore integrating their payment system so that you can make UPI to Singapore and Singapore to UPI easily. Part of that will include, you know, the Singaporean government saying that we understand and accept the Indian ID system and that we can trust the Indian ID system. And that now enables Indians and Singaporeans to transact. You can imagine a similar example where, for instance, Nigeria has a payment system and then, you know, Kenya has a payment system, and to enable trade, part of it is KYC, and they'll be like, okay, we understand the ID systems between these countries and we can acknowledge it. So I'll give you an example is that within the East Africa community, and that's because I have more knowledge about this, there was a discussion around we can be able to travel within the community, within the five or six different countries that make up the East Africa community, just using our IDs without using our passports, right? So now Kenya, Uganda, and Rwanda kind of enable this. And so, you know, a Kenyan can travel to Uganda, a Rwandan can travel to Kenya with just with using their IDs without any kind of passports. And so that enables those three countries to trade much more with each other. Now, Burundi, on the other hand, they did not adopt that kind of ID-based travel. Because, you know, when the Kenyan government and the Ugandan government looked at the kind of Burundi ID system, we're like, this is something you can trust. It's an easily forgeable document that you cannot trust. And just that, you know, kind of holds people back in that country. Now, when you look at now, just from a movement perspective, you can imagine what will happen from a, you know, digital financial inclusion, digital financial services perspective. So definitely some countries will be held back and some countries will move forward just simply based on the ID.
So this raises an important point and actually relates back to one of your four pillars. So it relates to interoperability, but it also relates to the pillar around intercontinental. I mean, you're talking about regional money movement, but yeah, intercontinental money movement.
Yeah.
And so that suggests something about how far along we are in building out this system. So from your perspective, is it still day one? Has a lot of progress been made? Where are we and what still needs to be done?
It's very early in the morning in day one. That's what I'd say. So it's still a long way out. I mean, there are strong attempts at building this kind of intercontinental money movement. One of them is PAPS, so the Pan-Africa Payments and Settlement System, which now enables central bank to central bank settlement, right? So you can transfer money from Nigeria to Kenya and settle in Naira and Kenya shillings, and the Nigerian central bank and the Kenyan central bank will just settle out those positions, right? There's a huge launch a couple of years ago, and a number of banks in Kenya, Nigeria, Ghana, South Africa keep onboarding into this system. But, you know, practically, you know, I haven't seen many PAPS transactions. One of the challenges always is some more technical term, but it's just like liquidity between currencies. And that's, from independence, has always been one of the biggest struggles of Africa, right? We have over 50 currencies and they don't trade easily with each other. And so whereas in Europe, you know, payments is very simple because you're using one currency, or even between the UK and Europe is very easy because the liquidity between dollar and euro is just amazing. That's a problem in Africa. And so, you know, in as much as you're using technology, and you know, it's you know, technology won't do everything, you can build out these systems, but there are more fundamental problems. But having said that, I think, you know, we've made a lot of progress. Companies like MFS are doing a great job. I think they changed their name, so sorry, I don't know what the new name is, but MFS Africa are doing a good job by, you know, connecting mobile money and enabling payments to happen through mobile money. At scale, this company will run into the same currency problems, and I'm sure they do. They still run into those currency problems where now you have this kind of illiquid currency pairs, right? So you're sending money from Tanzania to what? To Malawi? I mean, there are more Tanzanians sending to Malawi than there are Malawians sending to Tanzania. And so you find those problems in terms of now settlement. But, you know, so there's still a long way to go. And it's day one, as you mentioned.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've certainly heard that there are challenges with, this is not a technical term, but kind of like unpopular partners, as in there are routes where there is a lot of volume. And so it's a lot easier to support them. But with corridors where there is less volume, it makes less sense to support them. And so I guess almost by definition, there will be some parts of the system that are underbuilt because of, you know, the level of or the volume of transactions that do or don't happen. But what about the other goals that you mentioned? So you mentioned credit, you mentioned trade, et cetera. How far along are we in achieving some of those other goals?
So I'll speak about credit. And I think credit is, as I said in the earlier, like there's still such a long way to go. No single country, I mean, you could talk about South Africa, but to my knowledge, no single country in Africa has a system where businesses borrow on the strength of their credit score, or businesses and individuals borrow on the strength of their credit score. And, you know, the outcome is what we call market failure, right? The credit markets just don't function. People don't get credit, and therefore trade goes undone. An interesting statistic is that in Africa, only 40% of our trade is financially intermediated. What that means is that only 40% of our trade is supported by bank credit. Like someone got a facility from a bank and they were able to buy goods, right? Now, in places like Asia and Europe, this is close to 80 and 90%. So just from a pure gap perspective, that's around a $560 billion credit gap to trade in Africa. Like if businesses got financing for their trade, then they'd be able to trade much more. Now, that has a real impact in the economy. So I think I'll speak to maybe if you have Nigerian listeners. Nigeria is a huge exporter of pulses. So, you know, things like, pulses, green grams, all those kind of things, pigeon peas, chickpeas, and they trade them across the world. They export them across the world, mostly to India. Now, you could have a businessman who has access to the market. So he has people in India who are willing to buy whatever volume he can provide them. And they've given him confirmations that, you know, when you put these things on a ship, we're going to pay you. Now, this guy now needs money from the financial system to go and buy pigeon peas from farmers and everything. And he just simply cannot get it. So the farmers go unpaid. His workers go unpaid. The transaction doesn't happen. The country doesn't get FX. You know, a whole level of, you know, second order consequences. So, you know, just enabling credit markets to work properly has got a huge impact on the economy. And that's why I think like a lot of work needs to be done. And, you know, the kind of two go hand in hand. You know, if you enable credit, then more trade will happen. For the trade piece, I think it kind of relies on the first intercontinental money movement piece. And the more I think about it, like if you just make it easier to move money between countries, then people are moving money largely because of trade. And so we'll have solved that problem. So, yeah, those are the other pieces, credit being very important.
Right. So it sounds like the credit piece, at least in the context of business, is almost linked to productivity. I mean, I wouldn't use it in a strictly economic sense, but the idea is that you need credit to be able to basically secure what you're selling and enable the business. The assumption being that you might not always be able to purchase everything 100% upfront. So credit enables you to purchase more than you're able to quote unquote afford at the moment and build the volume of your business, which makes sense. I do wonder to what extent that logic applies when you're talking about consumer credit, but that's a conversation potentially for a different day. But I guess the bottom line is progress has been made, but there's still a lot of progress to be made. So on this, the subject of progress, are there any elements of this system that you're going to build a business around to deliver that are easier businesses to run? Meaning it's easier to make money, it's easier to keep customers, it's easier to protect your moat, et cetera.
How I'll approach that is not so much looking at, okay, so this business has money, you know, you can do this, you can do that. The way I'd look at it is incrementally. And the first thing is to look at, the way I look at businesses in Africa, if you want to build a really great business in Africa, and I could be wrong, you really need to look at the idea of market failure, right? And what market failure means is that there should be a market for such a business. There is demand, but nobody is providing it, right? And therefore, for some structural reason or another, this service goes unprovided. And the companies that did well is, you know, the first wave of telecoms in the early 2000s, right? There was demand for communications. There was demand for, you know, better connectivity. But the existing providers, you know, the national telecom companies were not providing it. And therefore, the telecom monies were able to, like, really build amazing businesses around that. Now, if you had come and said, you know, for instance, like email or something like that, which is enabled by telecom, that you need to go to your local post office and type out the email, and then it will be sent through the local post office to whoever it's going to, then, you know, the adoption wouldn't have been that great. Or, you know, you need to go to your local phone provider and, you know, key in the number of the person you're trying to call, and then now you can call him, then the adoption wouldn't have been great. So, like, there was a leap in terms of the level of service. So, there was market failure, basically. Now, you look at the existing system in terms of digital financial services. And you need to ask yourself, where is there a real market failure? That means that the market is there, but for some structural reason or another, the service not being delivered to the customer. And where does the market work? Because what happens in Africa is that if you build incremental solutions, then it's really hard to build a business around. Like, so, you know, the thing people say is like, we're building a better way of doing this, right? And the better is not 10 times better. It's just an incremental improvement. Then you're going to fail. So going back to the example, the how I'd frame it is, which areas do you think you can build a solution that creates a breakthrough, fundamental breakthrough, in terms of how this specific piece is done? So take credit, for instance. Can you build a business that creates a fundamental breakthrough in how credit is delivered to the final customer that creates trust within all players of the ecosystem? So, you know, some companies say, we give you ERP data and that enables you to do credit, right? But, well, you're just giving me the same data that I'd get through management accounts. You're just giving me through an API integration, right? Is that really what's going to make me lend more? Those are the questions you need to ask. So I'm not going to say that these are the areas that have potential. I'd just say that people need to think more around a framework for, is there a market failure? Is there a fundamental market failure? And does my product create a fundamental breakthrough? In some areas, you can build a business. In some areas, you won't be able to build a business using that insight.
Okay, so if we take the logic of fundamental breakthroughs as we begin to wrap up here, maybe as a foundation for talking about the future of fintech and what we might see going forward, are there then any components of this system where if they are built first, they will create fundamental breakthroughs that enable the rest of the system to quickly come online?
I think there's a lot of work that has to happen in intercontinental money movement. You know, players like MFS have created fundamental breakthroughs in that space by enabling inter-mobile money termination. And there's still more work being done by the likes of Flutterwave and Paystack to enable, you know, termination across all kinds of payment platforms. So, you know, cards to mobile money, etc. So there's work going on, and I think, you know, some of these large companies will, you know, they've had the lasting power, and that's a testament to that they are doing real work and they continue to do real work, right? If you look at financial inclusion, I think the fundamental breakthrough there was mobile money in large parts of Africa. I think the area where there's still a lot of opportunity is in the credit markets, and, you know, a lot of work is being done there. I think, you know, that's an area I see a lot of promise in terms of building businesses that now enable the digital financial system to work. It could be, you know, open data platforms that enable banks to now really understand who they're lending to. You know, one way of doing this is through enabling visibility into the business, understanding how the business is operating, getting insights into operational data. Like, these are the, if you could, you know, for a small business in Africa, it's a hard job, but it can be done. Is if you could get operational details into, these are their stock levels, these are the restocking levels, this is the last time they bought stock, this is how much they're selling per day. I think you can do a lot there in terms of now layering financial services that says, okay, if I have this kind of information, then I can enable such limits and enable this business to do way more. So I think credit is an area that has huge opportunity.
Indeed, I've heard similar, particularly about this link between lending/embedded finance and the actual operations of the business. To some extent, I suppose a lot of what we're seeing is about the stock inflows and outflows, but I suppose there are other aspects to it in terms of how the business is actually run. But the idea is that if you have access to data on how the business is run, and there are all different types of data that you can collect, then you're in a much better position to lend effectively and boost the productivity of the business.
And especially if that data is seen from an ecosystem perspective, and it's combined with covenants that everyone in the ecosystem agrees upon. So, for instance, you have banks, you have you know, manufacturers, you have all these people within the ecosystem, and you can then share that data across the ecosystem such that a businessman is like, if I default on this loan, it affects my probability to order more stock from this manufacturer. And because that manufacturer is in the ecosystem and they're seeing, you know, they're seeing all my data. So you combine the data and leverage through punishing bad behavior.
Yeah, I think that point about covenants is really important. I listened to another podcast called the Open Africa podcast, and they were talking about the, I'm going to paraphrase, poor lending culture in the sense that people don't always feel obliged to repay loans. And so if there isn't an understanding of the importance of repayment and that there's an agreement that this is how the system works, then things quickly fall apart. So in terms of thinking about the future, one of the interesting things I learned, again, from Chasing Outliers is that infrastructure building or vertical integration or owning the supply chain, however you want to describe it, is a strategic investment that a lot of startups have to make. But I also recall hearing in a DFS lab forum a couple of years ago, their head of entrepreneurship support, Joseph, said something to the effect that integrations are becoming more common, and that digital commerce companies were getting out of the infrastructure building business because it was sinking the business model. There's also this really nice visual article by Thea Sokolowski, the head of marketing and communications at Stitch, that shows the many, many, many integrations. I think it's 14, both in Nigeria and South Africa, that a mobile company might have to make to be able to operate. So not to influence your perspective, but do you think fintech is trending toward the super app playbook? So are we going to see a consolidation approach with a few do-everything players, or are we going to see the integration of many niche players or something else entirely?
I think it'll largely remain, you know, niche integrations. Like, I think I wrote about super apps, and you notice that in countries where there are super apps, so China, South Korea, Russia, there are always interesting frameworks around language, right? Like there are interesting nuances around language and culture and context. And there's no major super app in India, regardless of the market, right? And I think one of the reasons is that the consumers there are already catered through using the existing technology, right? For instance, WhatsApp, right? Like, in countries like South Korea, you've got KakaoTalk, and KakaoTalk is unique because of the intricacies around the South Korean language that WhatsApp just doesn't capture. The same for Yandex in Russia. And therefore, super apps respond, you know, operate when you can actually own the customer, and there's a fundamental reason for the customer coming onto your app. So, like, none of those factors really exist in Africa. And that, you know, everyone says we own the consumer, but no one really owns the consumer in Africa. And so saying that now, to abstract all these kind of back-end integrations, let me all put them towards a super app, I think you'll have to look at the cost of, you know, owning all those integrations and owning all that infrastructure and the likelihood of you monetizing it within the African context. And what's going to stop you from monetizing it within the African context are two things. Number one is that there's no cultural reason for having a super app. WhatsApp, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, all those things work perfectly, right? We're able to communicate within Africa. We're able to do all those kind of things within the continent. Then the second thing is that where super apps tend to work, there's a certain confluence of factors that need to come in, one of them being, you know, population size and GDP per capita, because these are largely Android, iOS-driven frameworks. So I don't think the idea that due to the fact that it's so difficult to make all these integrations, why don't we just compress them within a super app? I don't think that's sound logic for the continent.
And I think what's really important about what you're saying is that you're positioning it from the perspective of the market. So does any one entity actually own the consumer? What is the cost of owning and managing all of this infrastructure? What reason does a consumer have to come onto your app? These are all demand yeah. questions, where sometimes it seems like, at least from the outside looking in, the super app logic is driven by the desires and demands of the business builder and potentially the investor, as in, here is how we're going to extract additional value from customers. So I very much appreciate you making that distinction. So based on all of the learning, thinking, and work that you've done in the fintech space in Africa, what is a counterintuitive first principle for understanding what Africa's digitally enabled financial system will look like? And so when you answer this, if you could bring in the context you have about how we even got here, as in fintech as an opportunity didn't emerge just because there were sort of global trends and trends on the continent that made fintech a thing. So if you can bring that in, that would be great.
So the counterintuitive first principles approach to fintech.
Yes. Please.
That's a hard question.
It is. It is a hard question.
I think, you know, just going back to my answer. So the global trends, the things that drive fintech is, you know, increased understanding of the African context from a VC perspective. You know, all these talks about financial inclusion statistics. That's what's like kind of driving the interest around fintech, you know, in terms from a global context perspective. Of course, and, you know, generational issues such as Gen Zs and millennials, I think mostly Gen Zs having different approaches towards their financial lives as opposed to the older generations. That's all kind of demand factors. And I think more and more when, you know, based on my work on the ground is that just like how I answered the super app question, ultimately it boils down to the economics. What is the GDP per capita? What can people afford, right? And based on what people can afford, then, you know, where is the spending power that's going to finance, you know, these businesses from a revenue perspective? That's one thing. And if you use that kind of framework, then one logical conclusion, and it's arguable, is that, you know, the first winners, the first set of winners within Africa's digitally enabled financial system will be B2B fintechs that cater towards real African businesses, not other startups who are also doing business. And so that's where I think the first wave of African fintech success will be. If you're able to capture that spending power within the B2B space in Africa. And so that could be payments reconciliation, things like business credit scoring, business banking. I think that's that principle of looking at the spending power shapes my views to think that Africa's digitally enabled financial system in the future will really start with B2B fintechs winning. And then down the line, you know, once, you know, the economy grows is when now you'll start seeing the consumer fintechs now really mushrooming from there.
I really like how you structure that in terms of waves. So the first winners being the B2B fintechs that cater to African businesses. For whatever it's worth, that's a bit of intuition that I picked up in the previous series. The way that I understood it at that time was the way that SMEs would power this VC ecosystem, in the sense that SMEs are, this is a controversial statement, are inherently productive, or at least they're meant to be. I know there are a lot of challenges that need to be solved, but they're built for production, whereas arguably households are more so built for consumption. So by that logic, it makes sense that fintechs that serve businesses would be the first wave, and the consumer wave would come along a little bit later. So for better or for worse, that makes me feel a little bit more comfortable and leading into that intuition. But Samora, I am so grateful to you for joining me for this episode to help me demystify what it means and what it will mean to build a digitally enabled financial system for Africa. It was an amazing conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you to all of you who are listening, and I hope you'll join us again. You can find The Trajectory Africa everywhere you can listen to podcasts. Until next time.